Blog Talk Radio.
Okay.
Which you had to cut off.
We got just an hour in this guy. Today on Backroom Politics, Tuesday is primary voting day somewhere. Today it's in Wisconsin, Indiana, North Carolina, and West Virginia. Will Senator Lugar survive? Will a recall on Governor Walker be successful? Developing story out of D.C. Suspected underwear bomber plot thwarted. Raises the question, is Al-Qaeda still a threat? Obama's honeydew list. POTUS gives Congress a chore list. How should Congress react? China's dissident problem with the U.S. Who botched what? This and tell me a story today on Backroom Politics. Tuesday, when I'm in town, apparently. He is a former 8-term member of Congress from Washington State. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman, the Honorable Al Swift. Al, how you doing?
I am doing fine, and it is so good to have you back in person.
I'm so glad to be home. You have no idea. Oh, good Lord. I'll tell you about that later.
You do a great job in Oklahoma, but you do a better one in Chicago.
Well, that's very kind of you, Al. That could be the nicest thing you've said to me in a long time. At my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, when apparently I am available, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He served under, last count, 4 or 5 different presidential administrations. Longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and a very distinguished and handsome fellow at the Stinson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing?
Oh, I'm great. All is good in the world with you back in town.
I know. To my right, he is the Vice President of Eurasia Center. He is Vice President for China Affairs at the Eurasia Center. He's a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Dr. Ralph, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here with everyone.
Yes, Al.
And you can introduce Carl Bunovich.
Carl is on the walking in the door. Carl is walking in the door. He's the former chairman of the Democratic Party for the state of Maryland. Longtime Washington insider, Carl Toobin. Carl, how you doing?
I'm fine. I'm fine.
Grab a seat. Everybody's here. We're having a good time. Hey, lots to talk about, but since it's Tuesday, chances are somebody's voting somewhere. Today it happens to be in Wisconsin, West Virginia, North Carolina, and Indiana. Big stories, though, out of Indiana and Wisconsin. Let's deal with the first one, and that's going to be what's going on in Indiana. What's happening in Indiana is, for the first time in, well, for as long as some of us have been alive, Dick Lugar is in a fight for his political life. A longtime senator from the great state of Indiana, longtime old-school insider, and one who has not been afraid to cross the aisles and make deals in the Senate, Senator Lugar has really got a fight from the Indiana Secretary of State, who is giving him a real, real race. Al, is this surprising that we're actually talking about the possibility of Dick Lugar being unelected?
Well, I suppose it would be if it hadn't, if we hadn't lost the senator from Utah. And
Bennett,
and if the other senator from Utah,
Orrin Hatch,
hadn't been in such trouble for a while, he seems to have come out of that. So we're going through a period where, from my standpoint, insanity is at play. These were all good conservatives, but also good members. They tried to get things done. They did, in order to do that, make compromises. And Dick Lugar made compromises. But there's no question he was conservative. And there's no question that he put 30 years of excellent service for the nation, let alone Indiana. And for him to be in trouble, and polls indicate he's in deep trouble, is really a sad thing.
Does it surprise? I mean, Alan, you worked in the Senate for years and are familiar with the politics of what was going on, both on the Democratic and Republican side. Dick Lugar has always been one of those mainstays. Everybody liked him, had a lot of respect in the Senate, was kind of considered an old school politician up there, even in the later years in the 2000s. Does this surprise you as being a Senate insider that he's got a fight with Richard Murdoch?
Well, it saddens me. It doesn't surprise me.
Why does it sadden you?
Well, because he showed up in the Senate the same day I did. Now, he was a senator, and I was a staff member to another brand new senator, John Danforth, and they were elected the same day. And in 1976, they started in January of 1977, and he had people on his staff like Mitch Daniels, the current governor. This is a long time. This is 36 years that he had served. Things are changing. One of the things that you have to really admire about a Dick Lugar is he decided early on that he was going to focus on foreign affairs. He wasn't going to forget about everything else, and he did serve time as chairman of the Agriculture Committee, and that's really important in Indiana. But his great love has always been for foreign affairs. He's been a terrific chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He was a terrific ranking Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee. That committee is not fraught with all of the partisan battles that we see in other parts of the Senate. And now that's in a lot of ways being held against him, and that just saddens me.
But it also seems like, you know, when we look at Richard Murdoch, who was the state treasurer, not state secretary of state,
right.
State treasurer, Richard Murdoch, I mean, basically came out of nowhere politically and leapfrogged a lot of other possible incumbents for that seat and just basically springboarded up into the presumptive nominee. Is this the beginning of the anti-incumbent fervor that we're starting to see?
No, this isn't the beginning of it. This is an ongoing chapter in it. We saw a huge amount of that just 2 years ago. We've seen it in other elections, and we're now seeing it all over the world. Just ask President Sarkozy in France, or the ruling party in Greece.
I lived through two of these.
I mean, this stuff happens. We're seeing more of it. It's just particularly sad that Dick Lugar is going to be lost, because we don't have that many foreign policy experts in the Senate. Most people leave the Foreign Relations Committee when they can get on to a different committee, and he always stayed with it. He worked with presidents of both parties. He worked across the aisle. And his, you know, people always say, oh, he'll be lost, he'll be lost, he'll be lost. And I think in this case, though, given the relative scarcity of senators who are real giants in foreign relations and foreign affairs, it'll be a particularly painful loss. Now, don't let me say he's lost, because that election is going on today. Governor Mitch Daniels, who's very popular, is enormously loyal to Lugar. He is doing everything he can to help him. And Lugar himself was on the airwaves in the last 48 hours saying, hey, you know, Republicans are only 35 or 38% of registered voters in this state. Independents and Democrats, if you have a strong feeling about this, go to the polls on Tuesday, get a Republican ballot, and vote for me.
But, Al, when you look at the efforts that somebody like Senator Lugar has made going back and forth and working deals, as a Democrat, does it scare you that the days of the deal-making are over with a possible departure of Senator Lugar?
Well, it scares me in the sense that I don't know how an institution that is made up of two parties gets anything done if they don't cooperate with one another to some degree, and if they don't, find honest compromises. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to punish the people that do that, you're casting a vote for a Congress that can do nothing to solve our problems.
Ralph, from a foreign affairs standpoint, I mean, as Alan was talking, Alan talks about the effect that he's had on foreign services, the fact that he's dedicated his entire life to foreign affairs committee. Does that send a message possibly overseas to our partners saying, hey, look, America's got to clean up its own act first?
Well, I think the problem is, this is where Murdoch has been very effective, is he's saying that Lugar no longer lives in the district. He hasn't been there since the early 70s.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a second,
okay.
but as far as the effect, the vision overseas, the foreign government, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of our NATO allies go to Dick Lugar when they need something in the Senate. A lot of our alliances, i.e. NATO, have approached Dick Lugar as a supporter in the Senate. Is that something that's going to be noticed in governments overseas?
I definitely think so, because he's a true statesman. He's got a tremendous amount of respect among leaders of Western countries. He's someone that's been able to forge strong personal and business relationships. And I think he'd make a very good ambassador, you know, if he is defeated. He'd be someone you'd want to put out in the international sphere as someone that actively represents U.S. interests.
From a Democratic standpoint, Al, Dick Lugar is possible departure from the Senate. And, you know, again, the vote is still going on. The polls won't close until 7 o'clock Eastern. But when we talk about a possible departure of Dick Lugar, is Dick Lugar's departure something that can make Hillary Clinton's job as Secretary of State a little bit more difficult, particularly when it comes to budgetary?
Of course. You know, the thing that interests me is the two most sensible voices on foreign policy over the last 15 years have been Dick Lugar and the Vice President.
Dick Biden.
Joe Biden.
And you could watch them on the Sunday talk shows, and they weren't partisan. They didn't always agree, but there was a rationale and a calmness about them. And the Vice President, strangely enough, he's more powerful in a lot of ways, but he is not, you know, in the committee room and whatever where he used to be. And now Dick Lugar is gone too, or maybe gone. And if he is, you kind of wonder who are the people who've really been thoughtful students of foreign policy in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Alan, even from an international trade standpoint, obviously Dick Lugar has been very supportive of our international trade efforts. He has been outspoken on some of the trade efforts that did not necessarily make sense. Is Dick Lugar a factor in maybe even being a factor in increasing or decreasing our trade deficit?
Yeah, I think that would be a stretch. The Foreign Relations Committee is not one of the major committees that deals with trade laws. That's the Senate Finance Committee.
Right, but he didn't have an active voice, though.
Oh, he did. Listen, he was just a voice of reason and calm. And I reflect on this, and again, this is by no means a done deal, and he may yet pull this out. It's a sign of the times. I'm reminded, though, of a situation that was 30 years ago or thereabouts, when one of the real giants of the Senate at the time, Jacob Javits from New York, who also devoted an enormous amount of his attention to foreign relations, was beat by a young upstart county executive named Alphonse D'Amato, who basically said, Javits is maybe an interesting guy, but he doesn't spend a lot of time in the state, and we got a lot of potholes out here that need to be repaired, and he doesn't care, and he doesn't help us. And Al D'Amato became known. His nickname was Senator Pothole.
Right.
Now, he later got beat himself.
Right.
But it's a sad time for people who care about foreign relations and who know Dick Lugar, because he's just a really, really classy guy. But that's not a knock on Murdoch. It wasn't a knock on D'Amato. Things change, and, you know, Lugar made some mistakes politically, and he's 80 years old. So, you know, people do, you know, play out their strings sometimes.
Well, let's talk about those two chinks in the armor. One of them, his age. Al, I go to you. You weren't necessarily a spring chicken when you left Congress. Does his age necessarily affect his ability?
To tell you the truth, I can't remember your question.
Wouldn't be the first time that's happened, Al.
I was 60. I was not 80. I think there's something about 80 where the person who turns 80 and runs for office had better be very, very careful. Senator Magnuson, who was the most senior senator in the United States and chairman of the Appropriations Committee, lost. And he was in his 80s.
Dingell's been in a fight of his own in some instances.
Dingell is in a fight and he's over it. So that's just a thing you got to worry about. But the idea that everybody over 80 is no longer capable of putting wisdom and experience to work is simply wrong. I've often wondered this. I really don't understand the public sometimes when they want to get rid of people with experience. They would not hire a dentist who had never been to dental school. They would not hire a roofer who had never roofed a house. They would not do anything except send people to government who have no experience at it. It just makes no sense.
Carl, let's look at the other aspect, though. The other aspect was his mailing address. When Channel 6 out of Indianapolis approached him and said, hey, where do you get your mail here in the district? He couldn't even name his address, and when he did disclose his address, it was an address on a piece of property he had sold 10 years earlier. Is it the address that killed him, do you think?
I think it's part of it. There was a piece that I heard this morning that said that Murdoch, in his present position, traveled around the state of Indiana, met people who he worked with in his official capacity, met others, and really built a grassroots campaign. The other factor is that evidently the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee warned the senator that he was in a fight, and they didn't heed the warning, and it was almost too late when he woke up to find out that this situation was big. The thing that confounds me is that Senator Lugar has a farm in Indiana, a working farm that his sons run and he manages. And why was the his license at a place that he sold 10 years ago and not at the farm? That would have solved that problem.
You know,
Congressman Al,
this idea that you have to own property in your congressional district or your state is a shibboleth I've never understood. It means anybody who chooses to rent may not run for public office. You don't own property in the constituency.
Well, no, but it does require you to have a legal residence inside the district.
Well, of course, but talk to a lawyer about what that means and prepare to be confused.
But wait a minute, let me ask you this question, though. I mean, does when you look at something like that and then you look at Dennis Kucinich, who was trying to possibly run out of Washington State, I mean, that's carpetbagging 101.
Oh, absolutely. But a guy who's been a mayor of a major city in the state, who's been elected and reelected and reelected and reelected from the state, is a citizen of that state.
Right.
Come on. You know, it's ridiculous to consider it otherwise.
Would you say that for congressional districts?
Absolutely.
So as long as you've lived in the state, you can run for any congressional district you want.
Well, actually, that's technically true under the Constitution. It's not wise, but you really only have to run for Congress. You only have to be a resident of the state, not of your district. It's little known and very unusual. But
it's not wise. Politically,
politically
it's not smart.
You need to live in the
Alan district. Moore.
Yeah, I think I agree with Carl here that and all it is an observation. It's not like trying to defend it, because I wouldn't defend it. But the fact of the matter is, Lugar had not owned or rented property or a residence for 30 years. It was never a problem before, but it showed up now, became an issue. There was also some reimbursements that he had, because when he came to the state, he would live and stay in motels. Now sometimes senators have to travel around the state and stay in motels or stay with people, but he would have to go there whenever he went. He'd either stay with family, friends, or hotels, and he had to do some reimbursing. But I think that, A, there was no question that he's an Indianan. That's where his history is. But there are all sorts of things that happen in the world of politics that we can sit around here and disagree with. But this was a self-inflicted wound on his part. But after 30 years of it, why would he think that was the case? Now, having said that, an area that I don't totally disagree with Carl is I do believe that he has known for a long time that he was vulnerable. He didn't realize how vulnerable, and he didn't know what mistakes were going to have been made, what issues would become the big issues. But he had been trying to gear up and raise money. There was a lot of outside money, including three different big conservative organizations that spent and are spending a lot of money against him. One was the National Rifle Association. That's never somebody you want to mess with if you don't have to. And they were there big. The Club for Growth was big against him because he had voted to increase the debt limit at different times for the stimulus package. And then this other conservative pack that Dick Armey runs, I forget the name of it.
Right.
They were all spending big. There was millions of anti-Lugar money from non-Indiana sources. And when people don't go to vote in primaries that much, don't feel passionately about it, don't feel like it touches their lives all that much, guys like Lugar are going to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that out-of-state money can come in and criticize an incumbent for not living in the state? I think that's very, very interesting.
Well, let me,
I don't think that was their investment. Their investment was issues.
But it goes on. What I was going to say was the assumption is that they come back here and they get out of touch with the state and they're busy running foreign policy and they don't care about Indiana. Warren Magnuson, who was little known outside of our state, but he was a very, very powerful man in D.C., lived for virtually 40 years at the Shoreham Hotel.
Right.
I presume he owned some property in the state. But I remember when we would sit down at a delegation meeting, and he being the senior member, he would convene it. The first thing he would say is, what's going on in the state that we need to know about and do something about? And we'd go around and we would talk about that first. So he never forgot where he came from. And I think that's true of most of these long-term serving members.
Don't let that be the last word before we go to break, but real quickly around the table. Is Dick Lugar's political career done? Al?
Based on the polling, it would appear so.
Alan?
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say there's some miracle. Just because it's wishful thinking.
And I want a pink unicorn. Carl?
I would hope that his career is not done. I would hope that he wins tonight, but it's an uphill struggle.
Ralph?
I think he's done tonight.
I think, unfortunately, we're going to be losing a really senior member of the Senate that we don't want to. It sickens my heart, but I think Senator Lugar is going home. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other big story in today's primary. Governor Scott Walker in a fight for his political life out in Wisconsin. Can big labor beat Scott Walker? This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., live on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Thank you. 31 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., America's premier cigar lounge. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue our discussion about the primaries going on today in the great states of Indiana, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and West Virginia. The big story coming out of Wisconsin is the Democratic recall primary going forward to a June 5th head-to-head to either keep or oust Scott Walker as governor of that state. It is largely been known that the large, big labor organizations here in the United States have been against Scott Walker for his almost knee-jerk reaction to a lot of state labor relations issues, and thus started a recall petition that basically got about 30% of the total voter registrants in Wisconsin to sign on to a recall. That is a big number. But if you look at the numbers of people that are supportive of Scott Walker, there's a big chunk of Wisconsin residents that think he should stay as the stay in the governor's mansion there in Madison. Let's talk about what's going on today in the primary. The primary itself is pitting several Democrats. The two big ones, Dane County Executive Kathleen Falk and Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett are the two big names going around, and they're going to be fighting it out to see who's going to go head-to-head with Governor Walker. The big question right now is, and I'm going to start with you, Alan Moore, why is this a big deal?
Well, it's very rare that we get a sitting governor recalled, and in this particular case, he's being recalled over a law that he took the lead on and passed through the legislature that would basically eliminate collective bargaining rights of public employees in the state of Wisconsin. And once he succeeded narrowly in effect legislating away those rights, unions all over the country realized that this was a trend that was dangerous to all unions, particularly public employee unions, and they decided that this was worth trying to generate money and see what they could do, and lo and behold, there were a lot of people who had some sympathy with cutting back on public employee benefits, but not necessarily removing collective bargaining rights, and the issue took off. Now we're in this difficult, challenging Democratic primary where they'll pick a candidate. It looks like they're going to pick the guy who is the union's second choice, which is interesting, the mayor of Milwaukee,
the
former mayor
Tom
Barrett, Milwaukee. And this is no shoo-in. There will be millions, there will be tens of millions of dollars spent, and it'll mostly be out-of-state money. Most of the anti-Walker money is union money from all over the place. And most of the pro-Walker money is different kinds of corporate and big wealthy individuals and some PACs. So it's an ugly, messy thing. The outcome is not at all clear. And the biggest losers in all of this, I suspect, in the course of the final campaign is going to be public employees, not just in Wisconsin, but all over the country, because they're going to put a face on this stuff. They're going to talk about abuses and salaries and benefits that the public is not really aware of. If you demonize the public employee, it helps Walker. And that's what I think is going to be happening. And it's going to be a messy, ugly thing.
Al Swift, when we talk about this, we see a lot of, you know, I mean, the last successful recall of governor we saw was with Gray Davis out in California several years ago. That obviously gave us the governor in Arnold Schwarzenegger. But when you look at what happened to Gray Davis, different aspect. They recall Gray Davis basically on fiscal concerns, on his ability or his ability to run the state effectively into the ground financially, versus Scott Walker, which is inherently an almost ideological recall, saying you can't do what you're doing to labor. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I think that's a fair assessment. But when it comes down to trying to know exactly what's going on in Indiana, I think this is one of those things.
You mean Wisconsin?
Wisconsin. I see Nevada.
You said Indiana.
Indiana. All right. Somewhere in the Midwest. I don't believe that in a race like this you can make judgments on what's going on if you're not there. Many things you can. I think the Lugar thing, there's enough polling and it's cut enough one way or another that you can make educated guesses on it. I don't know about that. For example, Scott Walker may be unpopular, and certainly all those who support collective bargaining, we know where they're going to go, but you've got to keep in mind that organized labor has not always been popular. Labor goons is a term that's been used a lot, and so forth, and it's possible that a lot of people who don't really follow the logic of collective bargaining may just want to vote against the union bosses. So that will play. And then it just seems to me that you got the other side too that's hard to predict, and I wouldn't hazard a guess on what's going to happen there today.
I mean, is this something that other states, I mean, we're starting to see a trend. I mean, Gray Davis was an anomaly that we had thought would happen in a recall. Is this something that we're going to see a more of a trend in states that, hey, we're not happy, we'll just recall the son of a bee?
Well, I think that particularly in states that have initiatives and referendums and are used to going out and voting on issues and what have you, I think this is going to put a little more pep or poop in the issue. I think it's I don't like initiatives and referendums to begin with, so I think this is a bad trend. But we may see more of it.
But you look at, or go ahead, Alan Moore.
Yeah. We may see more, but I don't see this as the front of a wave. I think these are very unusual circumstances. California has this history of propositions and ballot initiatives, so it's not that unusual in California.
But Gray Davis wasn't busted down because of an initiative.
No, I'm just saying the legacy there, the history in California is for groups of people to get behind an issue of some kind and figure out how to either get it on the ballot and win or lose or make something happen. So I think Al's point was, well, you've got initiatives and referenda as part of your history. It's not that big a stretch to move to a recall. That's California. And California's budget situation back with Gray Davis was a disaster. And so you had enough people and enough money to get it going. In the case of Wisconsin, it was this perceived attack on union members and union rights that not just captured the attention of union members in Wisconsin, but also all over the country.
But was it an attack on union members specifically, or was it an attack on public service employees?
Well, if you're a union member, an attack on one is an attack on all.
An attack on collective bargaining.
But the point I'm making is, I think both those cases were pretty unusual, where you have a lot of outside interests stepping up and saying, we can't, this is unions, all not only public employee unions, which is a big enough group,
right?
It's the one that's been growing as opposed to other national unions that have been shrinking, but other unions also out there to stand together and to protect collective bargaining rights. So you've got enormous amounts of money at hand, as well as some people who feel passionately. That's what triggers this kind of thing. You don't you don't see the stars aligning like that all that often. So I don't see this as the front of a big wave of this kind of thing. It can happen, and every time it happens again, it causes people to think about it. But it's a lot of work and a lot of money.
Ralph.
I think Walker just became a very polarizing figure in the way he went after unions by trying to get rid of the collective bargaining, and it really galvanized the labor movement in a way that we hadn't seen for many, many years, and has certainly gotten the Democrats back on track to defeating Republican candidates.
Well, but let's look, good point, but let's also look at the fact, Alan brought it up, is, you know, when you look at referendums and you look at initiatives, I mean, it could be something like Proposition 8 in California. It could be the same-sex marriage ban that they're dealing with in North Carolina today. If the referendum doesn't pass, does this set up a possible, well, we didn't get our way, we'll start a recall vote? Al?
Could. It could. I would point out it's not just California. It's the whole West Coast, and it's almost anybody who had their state constitution done during the heyday of the populists. Back in what, 18 something or other, and they wanted fairly weak governments, and let the people in a lot. So yeah, I think if the people are angry in general, they're mad, they're anti-government in a lot of instances. It's kind of a menu for this kind of mischief.
Alan Moore, when we look at the overarching, almost divisiveness coming out of Wisconsin, it is almost the rhetoric going back and forth is almost acidic. Not just in the, you know, whoever versus Scott Walker, but even in this Democratic recall primary, it seems to have gotten a little tenuous in between the candidates. It's going to get worse before it gets better? Are we going so far down the path we can lose civility forever?
I don't know about losing anything forever. Forever is a long time. We lose it, we gain it, we lose it, we gain it. The pendulum swings back and forth. Although we've certainly been seeing it swing a little heavier in the direction of less and less civility, but it's not, all is not necessarily lost and not lost forever. Remember, we've talked about this before, we are currently in a horrendous, threatening economic environment, and you got frightened people who are scared about their own lives and scared about their kids' lives, and they're mad as hell. They're not going to take it anymore, and they're going to take it out on public figures, particularly incumbents. Incumbents, beware.
Wow, Alan Moore channeling Albert Finney. Nice job. Hey, Carl Toobin, you have a point.
Yeah, what Scott Walker did with the unions, I mean, he reversed history in Wisconsin. Yeah, Wisconsin was a very progressive state, had some of the first labor laws, had some of the first unions, and to take that and throw that away or reform it in his way that he reformed it was just absolutely shameful to a lot of people in Wisconsin. And that's what you had all the uproar about. Now, the other thing is that some of this is happening in other states. Ohio has the same kind of thing with Governor Kasich.
But they're not talking about recall with Governor Kasich.
I was just going to say, he did it in a different way than Scott Walker has done it. And I think that's part of the problem.
We're starting to see a resurgence of these lunch pail Republicans that are union members but also believe in fiscal austerity. They seem to be lost in the mix where they're saying, well, I kind of understand the recall, you know, i.e. a lot of lunch pail Republicans in Indiana with Governor Kasich. why is it now that Scott Walker is so subject to recall?
I think it's part of the tradition of the state of Wisconsin and the fact that he moved in and did this radical thing that most people saw as radical thing, and they feel, many people in Wisconsin feel they have a tradition to uphold, a progressive tradition, which includes collective bargaining and includes labor unions, that was taken away from
them. Wait, is this something, well, hold on now, is this something that you could see going forward in some place like Maryland?
No.
Why?
Because it's a whole different climate. You have a Democratic, you have Democratic governors mostly in Maryland who work well with unions, and so you don't have that situation.
Well, you had O'Malley, who was a Republican, who seemed to be working well with the public unions.
O'Malley is a Democrat.
Not O'Malley. His predecessor,
Bob Ehrlich.
Ehrlich. Right. Ehrlich seemed to be successful as working with the public sector.
So-so.
Alan Moore.
Well, and in Maryland, he did not have a Republican legislature. It takes an unusual circumstance, but again, in times of economic distress and uncertainty, one of the things that people resent is those in government. Now, whether it's federal government or state and local government or state government, or as in the case of Wisconsin and Walker in the legislature, or local government, today in the Washington Post, there was an article, and it's not the first, there have been numerous of these, about the fact that in Montgomery County, a very wealthy county that borders the District of Columbia, for years and years, retiring police officers are almost always retiring on a disability pension and benefit, which is significantly higher than the benefit that they would otherwise receive. This has gotten local news for a long time. It's a national issue, and at a time when public pension funds are grotesquely underfunded all over the United States, people are waking up to the fact that what we're signed up for, what, how much is their benefit? What, they're getting a retirement here, and then they're going to take a job over there? What, these guys who were physically fit and playing basketball and doing sports and doing this stuff are retiring as under disability and getting a higher benefit? What the heck is that? So it's back to the earlier point I said that there's going to be a microscope on perceived outrageous collective bargaining agreements that have occurred, and that's one of the ugly things that's going to be a byproduct of this recall in Wisconsin.
Well, we obviously still have to get through June 5th being the actual recall vote head-to-head between Walker and the Democratic winner this day. Let's talk about what's happening in North Carolina. And actually, there's one other item I want to pull out of what's significant today is the Ron Paul factor. Ron Paul still seems to be making waves. It was just discovered that the main delegate count is largely 85% in favor of Ron Paul. Same thing happening in North Carolina today. Even though Mitt Romney is a presumptive winner, there's going to be a delegate fight in North Carolina versus Mitt Romney. Is that something we need to keep an eye on, or is this just a red herring? Al Swift.
No, I don't think it's a red herring. I think, in general, our primary system nationally and in the states is all screwed up. How Romney wins Maine overwhelmingly and loses all the delegates, I don't understand that. I'm sure it could be explained to me. But we've got silly ways and archaic ways and incredibly complicated ways that make no sense to drag through the primaries. You can forgive the man in the street if he doesn't understand what's going on.
Alan Moore, is Ron Paul going to be a thorn in the side of the Republicans in Tampa?
Well, he may be a thorn, but you were talking about this as a wave, and I'm seeing a big placid lake and a rock thrown into the lake, and little ripples going out that eventually disappear. That's what I see about Ron Paul. I mean, he's fascinating. It's interesting. It's a reminder of you know, the lack of enthusiastic support for Romney, the unpredictability of the American electorate. So there was a news story today that, gee, lo and behold, Ron Paul went to, and his people showed up in Nevada at the convention and won over a majority of the delegates. Oh, except that only matters on the second ballot if there is one. And that was sort of buried in the story. So the headline was, Ron Paul emerges in Nevada. Well, they had caucuses there. Romney prevailed to a significant degree, and he'll get his votes on the first ballot. And I'm going to predict today, right here, right now, there will be only one ballot.
In North Carolina?
In Tampa.
In Tampa.
At the Republican convention. It won't be a brokered. You heard it here first, folks. Big news.
Ralph. What Paul's people are doing is they're going to all the state conventions trying to get delegates to come on board with the campaign. It's not going to be successful, but it is going to disrupt some state
conventions. It was obviously successful in Maine. Oklahoma, where
right.
he has a huge following, has
right.
got their Republican convention
right.
coming up. They're fully prepared in Norman, Oklahoma, to go and
sure.
do the same thing that they did in Maine. Is this something they could possibly do in North Carolina? Is this something they could possibly do in some place like Vermont?
It's possible, but the establishment Republican parties are well aware of it, and they have a procedure for selecting delegates. So if you look at 4 years ago, there was a huge uproar because Nevada was taken over by the Paul people, and then that caused the state party to establish new procedures so the Paul people want to have an impact, and you're going to see more of that in the near future.
But Al, when we talk about this, you know, we look at the balloting, we look at the delegate counts. Obviously, the projected winners in these primaries have been Romney or Santorum or another player, but Ron Paul still has the ability to affect change. Are we going to see a decrease in the delegate count going into Tampa from some of these places like in Oklahoma, like a Maine, like a Vermont?
I don't know that he has the ability to affect real change. He has the ability to screw things up. He has the ability to be very nettlesome. He has the ability to drive the pros that are running Romney's campaign crazy. But I don't think he's got the ability to change much.
Alan Moore, real quickly, when we look at all this, is this maybe something he probably will not run for president again, but with Ron Paul, we never know. Is Ron Paul basically setting a platform for Rand Paul to make a run maybe in 4 years?
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm, you know, if he is, this is like a floating platform without any foundation. Ron Paul is got an ability to speak to some feelings and fears that some non-trivial number of Americans feel. And they're willing to back him with checks and with feet on the ground, and it's quite interesting.
This grassroots ground game is something any candidate would love to have.
You know, I'm not enough of an expert or follower of these things to totally figure it out. I'm sure there's some important lessons there. Whether his son would be a beneficiary or not, I think that's a big stretch. Because he doesn't travel with his dad. He had a whole different approach and line in getting elected. It's an interesting question. I'm skeptical, though.
I think what Ron Paul is trying.
Al Swift.
I think what he's trying to do is to get a platform on which to promote his idea of what government should be. Now, that might, down the line, benefit his son. But I think the purpose is to be able to get his word out better than he ever has before. And if it helps his son, so be it.
And he's
got
a lot of enthusiastic young people that support his candidacy. If there's any way to turn them into long-term Republican activists, that would be great.
Carl?
I think you know, Romney group, it's almost like an affront. They're the presumptive nominee, and all of a sudden, this person comes and shows, and to a degree, how disorganized they are, that they haven't been on the ground looking at these things and making sure that their delegates hold and that they get their proportion of delegates that they're supposed to get in these different states on the first ballot.
When the other issue coming out of North Carolina today is a referendum on gay marriage. The gay marriage issue came to light this weekend, particularly with Vice President Joe Biden, where he said he was affable almost to gay marriage, which kind of sent the sent kind of Jake Harney into a little bit of a tailspin, along with the rest of the White House. But he's not the only one in the administration saying this. Is gay marriage going to be the third rail for the Obama White House, Al?
No. The strange thing that's going on here, the country is clearly, it seems to me, is moving right, and yet gay marriage is one of the issues that is gaining ground. And I think if we're going to wake up one day and find a majority of the Americans really don't give a damn who you marry and want to move on, and we'll leave these people who care very much about it, including the pros as well as the cons, with not much to fight over. As long as you put it to a vote, the antis have a better chance of getting out the vote than the pros. Some reason. I mean, it's almost always true.
But it seems like the Obama administration, Alan Moore, is starting to flip-flop on gay marriage. It stopped defending DOMA, but it took away Don't Ask, Don't Tell, basically giving gays rights in the military, but yet the White House will not come out and say, you know what, we're in favor of it, and to the point where it's got to do damage control on Joe Biden, which is not the first time.
But what I'm just saying is the country is moving in that direction. It's not there yet, and so it's still a little dangerous to do that.
Well, and interestingly, on this particular issue, African Americans as a group tend to be strongly opposed to gay marriage rights.
Right.
They are lagging behind, if you will, white America. I'm not sure where the Hispanics are, but I'm guessing that they're also, you know, hesitant.
They're very hesitant. Hesitant.
And culturally conservative.
And
right.
These are very important constituencies to Obama, who, not surprisingly, is trying to be careful. He doesn't want to get out in front of constituencies who are really important to him, not only in voting for him, but going to the polls to vote for him. So he's trying to have it both ways. And he's been talking for a couple of years about how his own views are evolving. Well, evolving, how much time do you get for the evolution?
Right.
And it's getting to the point where it's looking ridiculous.
Right.
And so much so that today, former Philadelphia mayor on TV said, it's time for Obama to man up on this issue. That was his phrase, time for him to man up and take a position. Is he for it or against it? How long do you keep doing that?
We have not seen on the Republican side even, you know, organizations that would tend to support, i.e. log cabin Republicans, have been strangely quiet on this position.
Well, I think their views are known, but they're not going to jump into this fight on the Democratic side. Now, there was some speculation that Biden's, I think, accidental remarks were, maybe this was a stalking horse. Maybe they sent him out there to do this. A guy like Joe Biden is not the kind of guy you want to send out as a stalking horse, because he's probably going to mess it up. So,
ask Jay Carney about that.
Yeah, and looking at it and thinking about it, my own view is that Biden said more than he intended to, that he was trying to talk about equal rights as opposed to, which could be in civil unions, as opposed to equal marriage rights. His words, though, don't reflect that, because he talk about men marrying men, women marrying women. I'm affable with all of that, or some such thing, and I think they should all be treated equal. Well, and then the White House was trying to say, that's basically the president's
thoughts and views of Joe Biden do not necessarily reflect that of the White House.
Basically, they were trying to recast the Biden views. A man and a man and a woman in a relationship should enjoy the same rights. But he was saying, men marrying men.
Right.
Women marrying women.
Women.
And the use of the word marry is critically important here, and I think that Biden kind of blew it. And then that's caused the press now to ask every member of the cabinet, what do you think? What do you think? And Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, was asked, and he said, oh, yeah, I'm a supporter of gay marriage rights. And poor old Jay Carney, I mean, hey, you know, he gets the big bucks and the big visibility, and that's what happens to you sometimes. He's been tied in knots. The press is more just having fun with the fact that they screwed this up, and so they're just sort of beating
Carl.
Interestingly enough, there was a African-American minister, evidently well-respected North Carolina, who gave an impassioned speech last night about this issue, this amendment, saying, number one, that it was worded wrong, and talked about how we've moved forward, and this would be a step back, and how can you take a step back in this state when everyone else is moving forward? And he evidently cited a case for a referendum on blacks, African Americans marrying whites in North Carolina, which was passed after the Emancipation Proclamation and
right.
all that, and how that passed, and how that was a step backwards. It took a long time to recover from that.
Right. Alan Moore.
Yeah, just as I understand the North Carolina referendum, I have not read it, but as I've seen it described, it would not only say no to gay marriage, it would also say no to civil unions. So
correct.
That's it leapfrogs where I think the country is in a place, and it's changing with age, so younger people are much more kindly disposed towards gay marriage rights than our older folks. So that's why it's just that's one of the reasons it's changing. The opponents are dying off. Now, and younger people are just more libertarian in their mind. Let people do whatever the heck they want. Keep government out of it. But in the case of the North Carolina referendum, because it goes beyond just defining marriage, but says civil unions somehow, they shall, any civil union shall not enjoy these kinds of rights either. That's why these people are really frightened by it, and why the outcome might be different. It could be affected by that murkiness about the exact language and what it would do.
I just was thinking, we've said two things here, and they may be connected. One is that the president is slowly evolving, and when is he going to get there? And we've also talked about the issue itself is evolving with the general public. I wouldn't be surprised if by the time the public gets to 51% for it, the president will have found that he's
for it. Yeah, but here's the problem, though. Here's the problem. Since 1998, gay marriage has been on the ballot in various states 33 times. The anti-gay marriage supporters have been successful 32 times. That's a pretty big batting average, which would lead anybody to conclude that everybody says, well, we're tolerant. I mean, I heard something funny the other day. Somebody said that I'm supportive of gay marriage because I want to see gay divorce. That's a reality TV show. I think that's terrible. How dare you touch my Pomeranian? You know, I get that. But there's still 32 times that this has been on the ballot, or 33 times been on the ballot, and it's lost 32. So Americans,
how dare you touch my Pomeranian?
Yes.
You're well organized and well funded.
It was the bottom line.
Justin, you and your euphemisms.
It was great. It was a great line. Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of things. First one is the latest underwear bomb scare coming out of the Middle East. Is Al-Qaeda really thwarted, or did President Obama give his mission accomplished speech? We're going to talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics. Oh, by the way, it's happy hour, so we're going to order our Jack Daniels, our martinis. Some of us have already been having one. And we'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Chili's Back Room for Happy Hour, our second hour here on Blog Talk Radio, live 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're going to start off our second hour and talk about the developing story coming out of Washington, out of the Middle East. It is a underwear bomb threat has been thwarted, apparently, in the Middle East by our intelligence community. The latest developing story regarding the underwear plot is basically the intelligence community talked of a new level of sophistication being brought forward by Al-Qaeda and trying to get stuff through our airport screening process. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano at a Tuesday town hall said there is a high likelihood the bomb would have been found if he had boarded a plane in the U.S., but all things considered, that it would have been detected and was not a threat to U.S. citizens. We're obviously analyzing the bomb as we speak. This coming on the heels almost to the week that President Obama was in Afghanistan unannounced and had a little bit of a document signing party with President Ahmed Karzai of Afghanistan, and basically signing a deal that would keep American presence in Afghanistan through 2024, basically another 12 years in Afghanistan. Number one, the big question that we have right now is, number one, is Al-Qaeda still a threat? I'm going to start with you, Alan Moore. Is Al-Qaeda still a threat? Do we still have to be concerned about
it? Oh, my gosh, yes. And we talk about Al-Qaeda as though we know exactly who they are. They're one unified monolithic group. There's all sorts of combinations and permutations of people who got their roots in Al-Qaeda, and we know that they're not getting any instructions, unless they're divine, from
Osama bin Laden.
You got a, you know, a bunch of crazy people out there whose goal in life is to kill Americans and undermine governmental structures in countries in the Middle East. What I don't get is why we're sort of bumping our chests at discovering a potential bomb threat, because there are probably scores of these things that are, that different guys in different ways are trying to pull off. And it's like, well, we got that one. Aren't we smart? It's a risky proposition. I'm glad we got them, don't get me wrong, and it's in a fascinating way, but I just as soon not hear about it in real time, because it simply, in my mind, is further impetus to these guys. Okay, they found that one. Let's go to plan B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. And where there's one, there's got to be others. So they are definitely a risk. We're spending enormous amounts of resources trying to figure out who these guys are, what their plans are, and sometimes we find out.
But it does seem, Al Swift, that our intelligence community has been successful in at least infiltrating the various sectors of Al-Qaeda and getting the type of intelligence that would lead to not only, you know, unraveling this plot, but also part of the intelligence that we got in having a drone attack that took out the sector of Al-Qaeda, basically Fahd al-Qasso, and destroyed a lot of its leadership in that drone attack. This on the heels of Obama going to Afghanistan, I have to ask the question. Was Obama going to Afghanistan, was that his mission accomplished speech?
No, I don't think that was his mission accomplished speech. And I think the reason that we make a medium-sized big deal out of the ones we thwart is simply that inevitably one is going to get through. I just think that the odds say that at some point one will get through. And I think being able to point back to all the ones we have foiled will be a helpful defense for the inevitable criticism that one did get through.
As we sit here and enjoy the great culinary arts here at Chili's Back Room, as I stuff my mouth, which is probably the only time I'm ever quiet, but I go back to you, Alan Moore. Hearing what Congressman Al said, do you think that Obama in Afghanistan last week, that was his equivalent of Bush's mission accomplished?
Well, okay, so let's yes and no. The very unfortunate, the most unfortunate thing about Bush's visit to that aircraft carrier was the mission accomplished sign, because it clearly was a very narrow mission that had been accomplished in a very, very large long-term objective. And it just looked ridiculous. The other thing that looked ridiculous in that particular case was him showing up in a flight suit on a plane. That was all unnecessary. So I would never defend that, and I don't think his people would either in retrospect. Having said that, it did strike me as bizarre that on the week where Osama, the anniversary of his death that resulted from billions of dollars in investment and untold numbers of lives lost, and efforts of electronic intelligence and human intelligence over a long period of time, we figured out where the guy was with a reasonably good probability, and we went in, got him, and it worked. And how terrific was that? And it was a long time successful effort by the military and by the intelligence community and a president who was willing to say, in the face of some not inconsiderable risks, let's do it. Let's go for it. A lot of people would have said, let's do it. We don't know what others would have done. But, you know, having said that, and I don't mind paying attention, I'm not comfortable with him being the guy who's, and I'll use the phrase, spiking the football,
right,
even if it's a year late. I'd like other people to say, wow, that president stood up. He made these hard decisions. Wow, this was a much tougher call than you know. For him to be out there, for him to be doing it, for him to give a political speech from Afghanistan to the American people. He wasn't talking to the Afghanis, for God's sakes. There was no simultaneous translation or anything else. He's standing, looking straight at the camera, talking to the American people. Yeah, that put more politics into it than I was comfortable with. You know, in politics, you use your strengths, you minimize your weaknesses. I wasn't grotesquely offended, but it did bother me.
But you look at the deal that we struck, you know, another 12 years inside of Afghanistan with the U.S. support. But we also have to tie in the fact, the other news coming out of Europe is the fact that French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been defeated by a less than really hugely supportive American proactive president who is a known socialist Republican. The new president of France is going to be a factor. Is this something we got to be concerned about going forward in our war against terrorism, Ralph?
Well, I think it's interesting because Sarkozy was very popular on the international front, but he had a lot of problems domestically within France because there was high unemployment, and people in France want government jobs and they want increased spending. They don't want to deal with the austerity measures that Sarkozy and his team were talking about.
But are we going to see a shift in support on the war against terror from France now that Sarkozy, who is arguably the most pro-American leader we had in Europe, other than David Cameron, are we going to see a shift in policy? Is he going to, as he said he would do, withdraw French forces by the end of the year?
I think that's entirely possible. I do think, though, that Obama is going to work really hard and encourage him not to do that. And Obama,
will he be successful?
I think it remains to be seen. I think Obama has a lot of pull with these European leaders. He has a very good personal relationship with them. But at the end of the day, you know, it could be that Obama fails on that front.
Interesting. Alan Moore.
It seems hard to pass on the subject of the
change with your mouth full.
The change of the change. Thank you. I appreciate that helpful advice.
Mom would be very disappointed in you, Alan.
I appreciate. I think it would be a shame to pass on the French elections without reflecting on the fact that Sarkozy's wife was a babe.
And referring to French. Former French First Lady Carla Bruni.
And Holland, who's not married, has got a babe of a girlfriend, of a mistress, as they say in France. What is it with these short, middle-aged French political leaders who are able to attract these taller...
Hot babes?
Hot babes. I mean, I...
Well, we just lost the women demographic on the show.
Thanks, I'm just... kind of stunned. How does this happen?
Sarkozy's wife was not necessarily popular herself. She came across as a little arrogant.
But she could. She was hot.
She was. But if you're trying to get votes for your husband, I mean, you got to be a little more humble there.
You don't have to be humble to be a babe. Okay.
Well, but at the end of the day, she lost it.
No. I think she...
Congressman Al.
There's an old theory, which may be terribly sexist, or it may be true.
Why stop now?
I don't know whether it's one or the other. But that women are drawn to power.
Right.
Men are drawn to physical beauty more than anything else. Because we're all little boys at heart, or teenage boys at heart. And that women, you know, it's frankly, it's one of the problems in Congress, is that members of Congress have a hell of a lot more opportunity to be unfaithful to their wives than anyone can possibly imagine. And that we don't have more scandals is kind of testament to the loyalty of a lot of members of Congress. But I think that had something to do with it.
Wow. There's obviously something in the water. I mean, because let's be real. Nicolas Sarkozy wasn't exactly a, you know, a stud himself, but
we don't know.
I'm so glad we've denigrated this show to this level. You know what? I'm going to take moderator's approach. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk something back stateside. The president apparently has given Congress a honey-do list. That's going to bode really well up on Capitol Hill. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. We're continuing our political roundtable discussion. We're going to take a look at the latest coming out of the White House. Basically, the president has given Capitol Hill a honey-do list. Basically, a little list of things that he wants them to do before they go to bed this weekend. It is a 5-point legislative to-do list. It includes measures aimed at creating jobs, helping struggling homeowners manage their mortgages, tax credits for businesses that are creating jobs, a whole litany of items. But basically, it's the White House telling Congress, I want you to do this, don't ask me any questions, just do it because I told you so. That apparently is not voting very well on the Hill, with several members of leadership. Real quickly, I'm going to go to you, Al Swift. Why, in God's name, would the president send a honey-do list up to the Hill?
Because they haven't been doing a damn thing, and he's set out a list of just 5, not huge things, It's not a balance the budget my way or pass health care my way or any of those things. Things that are doable. And the Congress can run from it, but they just hand him then. The list becomes from a honey-do list. It becomes from a they-didn't-do-it list for the campaign.
You, Carl.
It becomes more of a do-nothing Congress that he can run against. And he will, and I think that's why he's doing it. These are things he's wanted. He hasn't been able to get them. He says to the American people, I'm sending this to Congress. They're going to reject it, and it's going to be to set the stage of a battle.
And the Republicans should do the smart thing and pass the ball.
Yeah, but wait a minute. I mean, the Republicans have come back. Spokesman for House Speaker John Boehner said, quote, we've passed nearly 30 jobs bills to increase American competitiveness, expand domestic energy production, and rein in red tape. Democrats are blocking every one of them. Is this just basically another Democratic ploy to make Congress the whipping post? Al?
Well, I think it serves that purpose as well. But there are also things that Democrats would like to get done, and they are the least controversial of things that he could put out there. And it puts the Republicans in a difficult position. They can give answers like that, which Joe Public doesn't understand. They can say, yeah, but. But the fact is, they would do themselves a hell of a lot of good to pass them and say, so there.
Yeah, but Alan Moore, you cannot argue the fact there have been, in fact, 30-plus job bills that have come up, stimulus bills that have been passed that were supposed to create jobs, and the number of jobs created have been minimal.
Look, we've got a Republican House where all you need is a simple majority, and a Democratic Senate where you've got to get 60 on anything big. So it's really hard to get everybody together. What the president has done here is nothing more than a pure political ploy. As Carl said, he lays some stuff out there. It's not crazy and unreasonable, as Al said, but it probably won't get done, and then the president will be able to beat the Congress like a drum and say, you need me to keep pushing this stuff. Now, he would have a lot more credibility on this if, after he had been elected, he had not just bent over in doing the leftover appropriations bills and said to the Congress, nope, you guys do them, I'll sign them, and they larded it up. Months later, stimulus package. Did he take the lead? Nope. Said, Congress, whatever you think. Larded it up with earmark after earmark. When it came to the big health reform package, although he invested all of his time and effort on that rather than on the economy, he also deferred enormously to the Congress. Now he's embraced the bill as though it was his bill and it was everything he laid out. I mean, he has foregone the opportunity to be a true leader early on, sort of set the template for this whole Congress and for his administration. Now he's trying to hang on for dear life and get himself elected by saying, I'm just asking for a few things here. They're not unreasonable, and the Congress won't give them to me.
Congressman Al.
Well, I think that's one interpretation. Another interpretation is that he tried to cooperate with the Republicans on major issue after major issue after major issue, withstood the criticism that he wasn't giving enough leadership. And now he's past that, and he provides some real leadership, and the Republicans are bitching about that.
Well, to support that, the president did say, when talking about his honey-do list, he says, quote, I sent Congress a jobs bill, and it included all sorts of policies that we knew could grow our economy and put Americans back to work. Just about every time we put these policies up for a vote, the Republicans in Congress got together and they said no, unquote. That's a pretty telling sign back up to Capitol Hill. I mean, he basically puts the ball back on Capitol Hill, Al.
Yeah, he does. Now, one of the things that the public doesn't understand is that the things that the Republicans put forth that they claim did all these wonderful things, and probably the things the president has put forth, all have what people in Washington, D.C. recognize when I say a poison pill. In short, yeah, they might have done what they, or tried to do what they said they would do, but they always made sure to have something in there that the other party could not possibly agree to. And both sides play that game.
Ralph?
Well, let's say the Republicans pass some of these things on the wish list. Ultimately, who benefits at the end of the day? Is it Obama or the Republicans or both sides?
Well, I think both sides. Okay. It takes an issue away from the president, but it gives both sides the ability to say we can function, by God. And so I think that there's not a lot for the president to lose in doing this.
Alan Moore.
And I agree with that.
Which is why I say it's largely a political exercise. It's not the big stuff that the country needs. It's not the aggressive short-term stimulus or the long-term deficit reduction ideas about which we continue to have heard very little. We will never stop talking about the horribly missed opportunity of getting behind Simpson Bowles. When a bunch of liberal Democrats and a bunch of conservative Republicans said, let's do it, and the president had cold feet. And that was, I think, a reflection of listening too much to some political advisors and not having enough experience.
Well, let's look at some of the stuff on the list.
I tend to agree with Alan on that, with reservations, but it's fundamental truth.
Okay, but let's look at some of the things on the list. I mean, you're talking about 20% tax credit for moving overseas operations back on U.S. soil. The Republicans have proposed similar legislation, and why is this all of a sudden Obama's big champion point? Well, Alan?
He's picked out a handful of things that he thinks will play well, and as Al Riley points out, most of these have poison pills in them, and those are less obvious. And an easy example is what's going on right now on the interest rate charged on student loans. It's at 3.4% a year. That's actually kind of a high interest rate these days, and it had been reduced, or it was supposed to double, and it was temporarily held back. Now we have the president traveling around.
Which, by the way, that bill failed in the Senate this afternoon.
That's where I'm getting it. But let's think. But what I'm saying is the president last week is wandering around to college campuses as though he's the guy who's going to save all these kids. You got Republicans who say, we're with you. We want to hold it at 3.4 for at least another year. And there's some question about whether it extend longer than that. He's out. The president's out there saying, this is politics. I don't have a quarrel with somebody playing politics. I'm your guy. I'm going to save you. Tell the Republicans. Call the Congress. And it failed today because in the president's proposal, there's something that's perceived as a poison pill by Republicans. It's not that easy to get the Republicans to stay united. Even Olympia Snowe, who's stepping down, she voted present. She didn't vote with the president. And by voting present means you're not getting up to 60, so it's like a vote against the president, and every other Republican voted against him. Why? Because of the pay for. So how do you pay for a multi-billion-dollar change in the law? You got to figure out some sort of offset, and they argue about the offsets. I'm not defending the Republicans' offsets. They're political gamesmanship too. They want to take it out of a health prevention fund that's part of the Obamacare bill. That's a non-starter with the Democrats. I mean, both sides play this game, but let's not pretend that the president is suddenly the statesman in all of this, and it's only the Congress who's playing politics. There is politics all around.
Ralph.
And I think the Republicans have hurt their image with young people with their opposition to going along with the student loan rate. I think they have to do a better job of marketing themselves to young people and a better job of explaining why they are opposed.
Yeah, but wait a minute. A Democratic Congress, a Democratic-led Senate today voted down the student loan bill.
Well,
so the Democrats obviously could have rallied enough using the you got to get some young votes. I mean, you got radicals in there, some more moderate Republicans like an Olympia Snowe and that sort. Who Scott Brown, for example, another one.
Trust me, We will get there. The student loan rate will not go above 3.4% for next year. We're just not there yet. We're going to play out the little dance.
Well, let's go back to
try to develop some political arguments against the other side before you cut your deal.
But there's also other aspects of this honeydew list that obviously the Republicans have proposed solutions to some of this. Al, why are their solutions any different than what the Democrats are proposing?
I do not know the specifics of either proposals, but I will almost guarantee you there's a poison pill in each of them.
Yep.
Interesting.
Which means you got to find a middle ground, and they will.
And when you deal with a good idea that both parties tend to agree with, the place where you work your compromises, place where the deals are worked out, is getting rid of the poison pills in some fashion. That's what you have to sit down and do hard bargaining about, and you have everybody walks away a little dissatisfied, but having got something, and then you can pass the bill in spite of what was a poison pill. And they're not in a frame of mind to do that as yet.
But, I mean, Al, you're a former member of Congress. If the president, regardless of party, had sent up a to-do list in the almost blatant manner that the White House did, basically putting it out there as a supposed post-it note, would you have taken offense to that?
Had a Republican done it?
Yeah. If a Republican had done it, would you have taken offense to that?
It would depend on, for me, it would depend upon what the five or so things were and what the poison pills were. The party, in general, would, to be honest, would naturally oppose it.
Really? Alan?
I think politicians don't take offense at the opposition taking advantage of political opportunity. That's what's going on here. Now, it can be annoying and frustrating, but it's not offensive. It's, well, of course he does that, and of course we respond this way, and we do the dance, and eventually we'll get some of this stuff done. It's just that it won't be done with the president's poison pills, and it won't be done with the Republicans' poison pills, and it may not all get done, but this stuff is not the big stuff. The big stuff, we're not even talking about.
What we don't have is something, and Bob Hines tells this story frequently, and he is unfortunately not with us today, or I would ask him to tell it. But he was out at Burning Tree once when Tip O'Neill and Gerald Ford, then the Republican leader in the House, finished their round of golf, and they had cars there to take them where they wanted to go. And Gerald Ford said, "Well, Tip," he says, I'm going home and have dinner." And Tip said, "Well, I'm going back up to my office and kick your ass." And that's kind of, you know, in the days when people got along and understood what the other's role was and didn't get offended by it, it was obviously a Tip O'Neill joke, but that's what both were trying to do during most of the time, was to try to get one up on the other.
I agree, and I see your point, but in today's venomous, almost cordial environment that we're experiencing here in Washington, Alan Moore, this is obviously something not helping the situation when you have to put it up there as something as simple as a sticky note.
You know, it's politics in the details is constantly evolving. This is old time politics. And Al points out a story of long ago of two guys had a lot of respect for each other, a lot of affection for each other. More so, I would say, than a lot of people have now towards each other. But it's, you know, it's the details that change, not the one-upmanship, the jockeying for advantage. So I don't see this as a big major move. It's no big surprise. Wasn't grotesque ask. Wasn't terribly offensive. Pretty obvious that he's trying to score some points.
Al Swift.
I remember once, it was some local office, a county office, I think, and I was kind of husbanding the Democratic candidate, and and a good friend of mine by the name of Ken Knuckles, who was at one time not only the county chairman, but he was chairman of the Western States Republican Conference. So he was good, and he was supporting the other guy. Well, his candidate said something profoundly stupid. And Knuckles edged up to me and he said, "You want me to write the press release?" And that's the way it used to be. He knew he was going to take a drubbing on that issue, and he was letting me know that he knew.
Interesting. Bottom line, though, is this something that's going to make Congress take a look at and maybe get some of these initiatives passed through? Carl Duvin.
Hard to say. I just, you know, the whole history of the last 2 years is the Republicans have just said no. And I think this is going to continue until we get some a modicum of civility and get some people in the Congress who are going to try to reach across the aisle to one another and try to really do some cooperation. There are committees that do that. This afternoon we were in the office of the Indian Affairs Committee. The offices are together. I mean, they work out of the same space. There's some other committees, Veterans Affairs Committees, usually work together, Republicans and Democrats. And somehow or other, you have to get more of this going where people reach across the aisle and talk to their counterparts on the other side and come to some, create some new civility to turn this thing around. Hopefully, after this election, the next Congress, this will happen.
Well, interesting point. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about last week's China debacle with a dissident who happened to show up miraculously at the U.S. Embassy and now is a matriculated student at a university up in New York City. When we come back, we'll talk about that, and then we'll close out the show with Tell Me a Story. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
Thank you.
country, a part of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're going to close out today's show. We want to talk about something that happened last week that continued to bleed over into this week. That is the situation dealing with the Chinese human rights dissident, Cheng Guangcheng.
Very good pronunciation.
Oh, thank you very much. I've been working on that puppy. So anyway, Cheng Guangcheng originally was in a Beijing hospital under the protective status of the U.S. Embassy over there. Caused a huge rip in Sino-American relations, basically giving him defection status here to the U.S. Ralph, as our Sino-American expert, want to talk to you. How bad of a botched situation was this on both sides, both here in Washington and Beijing?
Well, here was the situation. You have Cheng Guangcheng. He escaped house arrest, and he went to the U.S. Embassy, where he was protected for about 6 days. When he got to the embassy, he didn't actually ask for political asylum. He said, I'm a victim of political corruption, and I want you to help me to have President Hu revisit my case to show that I am an honorable person, that I am trying to expose corruption in Shandong province. And that's where the situation became a little tricky. The U.S. government didn't want to get involved. They were trying to, according to Chen and some other sources, encouraging him to leave the embassy. And it got a little dicey. You've got the Chinese Foreign Affairs Ministry that was trying to work directly with the U.S. Embassy to resolve the situation. They were coming up against the security agency in China that viewed Chen as a criminal and wanted him severely punished for disgracing the country and creating all of this this public image that hurt China.
But did the fact that the corruption in the Guangcheng province, which obviously you've got the wife of the political party leader in Guangcheng, who was arrested for basically murder of a British businessman
right.
in a hotel room
That's
in the province.
That's the vote she lied.
Right.
Yeah.
Did that help promulgate this situation? Was that in addition to what was going on with Cheng Guangcheng?
I think so. It sort of followed up on what happened with the Bo Xilai situation. But I think the Chinese government couldn't necessarily be upset with the U.S. over Bo Xilai because we didn't necessarily house the ex-police chief. I mean, he came there for advice and then he left. This Chen Guangcheng ended up staying in the embassy for about 6 days trying to figure out what he was going to do. He kind of changed his story, so to speak. First, he didn't want to leave China. He wanted the U.S. government to help him have his case revisited. And then he decides, well, no, I don't think I'm going to be safe. I need to leave. I fear for my family. I want to go with Hillary Clinton when she leaves China. I want to accompany her back to the U.S.
Is this the beginning of a new Sino-American Cold War?
I don't think so, because I think the U.S. is going to stay engaged, but they've encouraged Chen to apply.
They've already given him status. They
right.
mean, he filed
right.
proper paperwork in
right.
Beijing. The Chinese government has said, okay, if you want to go to college here, go to college.
And he's going to
be matriculating at a college in New York City.
And I think that's what the Chinese want. They really want to get rid of him. He's an embarrassment and hurts their public image. So the sooner they can get him out of China, the better.
Was he necessarily wrong? Is corruption that prevalent in Guangzhou province?
It's hard to say because in a lot of these provinces, the central government doesn't necessarily know what goes on in the province. They rely on the people that they select to represent the Communist Party in the province. Now, what happens with these officials is they recognize in order to get promoted, we have to do two things. We have to bring business into our province, and we also have to promote public health, safety, and welfare. So someone like Chen, who comes up, who is a thorn in their side, who exposes some possible issues with forced abortion and sterilization, they're not going to want him out there kind of talking about what's going on in the province.
But is this a political issue or is this a civil, human rights issue?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think Chen initially was trying to work within the system through his lawyer to expose an issue of political corruption. but he didn't necessarily make a lot of powerful friends in the province, and that's what ended up hurting him at the end of the day.
Interesting. Yeah, go ahead, Alan Moore.
Just a word, and Ralph just touched on it. Chin's big issue, the thing that got him onto the radar screen of human rights activists around the world, and particularly in the U.S., was the fact that he really did blow the whistle on these regional behaviors of forced abortion, forced sterilization, and cases of infanticide, particularly gendercide, of young girls who would be killed at birth. This is all part of a very controversial One China policy, which our government has had difficulty trying to figure out how to deal with. There was the famous incident just a couple of years ago where Joe Biden publicly said, you know, hey, when asked in China, what do you think about this? He said, well, you know, in China, we don't like to mess around with your internal affairs. And he was ripped apart back in the States and forcing a bunch of revisions to his comments that, no, we do abhor this appalling kind of behavior. This guy had been on the radar screen to the U.S. Hillary Clinton was, and others had talked about his case for a long time. So he was a hero in some places in the U.S. and elsewhere for his calling attention to this really, really grotesque behavior that was part of the way government functioned there. So that was the backdrop to why it was so interesting how he was being treated.
Right. Well, we're gonna have to close this down real quick. We've got a party coming in here to the back room at Shelley's back room. But we're going to close out real quick with my favorite part of the show. Tell me a story. We're obviously going to keep an eye on this Chinese situation. That's obviously something still in development. But tell me a story. I'm going to start with you, Al Swift. Congressman, tell me a story.
Once upon a time, there was a congressman who retired and who became part of a radio program on the Internet. And he really enjoyed it, except for one part in which... they said, you got to have a story every week. and my story is, I don't have one.
Oh, there it is. It took us 2 minutes to get to that. Alan Moore, tell me a story.
Sorry. We filled up his requisite time. Okay, so once upon a time, there was a really interesting Senate race in the normally reliably Democratic state of Massachusetts, where, lo and behold, a little-known guy named Scott Brown got himself elected to the great embarrassment of Democrats in Massachusetts because he got elected to fill the unexpired term of one Ted Kennedy, the lion of Democrats and a terrific, highly productive senator who also found ways to offend people with some regularity, too. But he was a remarkably accomplished and productive guy. So Scott Brown is now in this race with this woman, Elizabeth Warren, who was made a bit of a hero for tackling Wall Street and the behavior of big banks. And it looked like, and it still looks like, it's going to be a really interesting race. And she's up and she's down and a lot of outside money coming in. And then this week, Elizabeth Warren, for reasons no one will ever know, totally mishandled a piece of information from her past. It was as though, and it shows kind of her lack of preparation, she wasn't prepared to be called on the fact that for many years she called herself and checked off boxes on employment applications as an American Indian or a Native American. And back then it was American Indian, and she was listed in the Harvard Law Directory as a minority.
Right.
When asked about this odd bit, she totally fumbled the answer. She has still not clarified exactly whether this was done for the purposes of trying to get a job under minority set-asides and minority preferences, although there's some evidence that that was part of it, but she doesn't want to admit it. I think that this thing, which is still alive, still not fixed, could change the whole nature of that election. And now, whereas it was a toss-up before, I think it now leans
towards
Scott Brown, who's a very good retail politician, and she really messed up.
Wow. Carl Toobin, in 30 seconds, tell me a story.
Real fast. I think it's the uproar about this China thing got Mitt Romney to come out and say that this is really bad for the United States, it's bad for human rights, and da-da-da-da-da. And I think that, in my mind, that he should have waited until this thing was settled diplomatically or whatever, and then made a comment if there was a criticism to be done. I think he put himself in a bad situation.
Ralph, 30 seconds. Tell me a story.
I have been selected as an alternate delegate to represent the state of Hawaii for Mitt Romney
in Tampa.
Tampa.
Congratulations.
Thank
nice
you.
Job.
One other thing.
Real quick.
The White House is signaling that a deal with Iran over the nuclear issue is imminent. Iran has signaled the same thing. Look for a decision after May 23rd.
Wow. Interesting. Give me a deadline. My story is my home county down in Florida, Brevard County. Brevard County elders decided to pull the book, the mommy porn book, 50 Shades of Grey. After the story hit in the New York Times and the London Daily Mail, the Brevard County powers that be have decided to put back 50 Shades of Grey, and they will return it back to the shelves here in the next week or so. Mark my words. Anyway,
Catcher in the Rye in the library.
It is in the Rye. Wow, I'm not even going to go there. I'll talk to you about that next week. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Alan Moore, Carl Dubin, Dr. Ralph Winnie, I am your host, Radio Justin Russell. I will be back from Oklahoma next week. It will be a divided show. But stay with us. It's always good, always entertaining. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street. In the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., Al
says, Bob, this is the place to be.
We exactly. Miss you, Bob.
Exactly.
Come back soon.
We'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.